This is WMRA's Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from the WMRA newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky.
The opportunity to be around other people who have diverse skills in art and science and technology. The makerspaces create a home for those people.
That's Dan Funk, one of the partners at Stanton Makerspace. Now, if you haven't heard of this nationwide phenomenon known as makerspaces, you're in for a real treat. WMRA's Kara Lofton will take you on a tour of these new places for creativity in Stanton and Charlottesville. And to continue the creative theme this week, Margie Greenfield will introduce us to the educators behind the Fine Arts Academy at Harrisonburg High School. And from December, Sefe Imakpai dives into the visual arts community in Charlottesville. Stay tuned for Second Look, but first, this news from NPR. This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. We'll have a replay of this week's installment of The Spark. It's a conversation with Sophia Wiedemann, who has been drawing cartoons her whole life. What kind? To what purpose? We'll meet her a little later. First up, what if there was a place that existed just to provide space to create? In this space, you could make almost anything you wanted, and you could do it alongside other creative innovators. Such places, called maker spaces, are beginning to crop up in cities all over the United States, including Charlottesville and Stanton. WMRA's Kara Lofton has the story.
For Stanton Makerspace partners Dan Funk and Jim Rutt, makerspaces are the libraries of the future. They're public, community-driven places for new ideas and innovation in which people can come and just make things. Stanton Makerspace operates out of a converted warehouse in downtown Stanton. There, Funk and Rutt have amassed a variety of different power tools, computers, a 3D printer, and an open-source CNC router for members to use. Currently, Stanton Makerspace is subsidized by Funk, Rutt, and other members who go beyond the membership fee to put their own money into rent and equipment. Funk said their dream, though, is that as membership grows, Stanton Makerspace can exist solely on membership dues.
I think that over time, what will happen is that access to equipment and the opportunity to be around other people who have diverse skills in art and science and technology, the makerspaces create a home for those people to collaborate and build and learn and do things.
Makerspaces have existed in cities around the country for years, but are not always well known, even to the communities they serve. Like Stanton Makerspace, most of these tech-based societies operate off of a membership model. Members pay a fee and are able to use the facilities and equipment to make anything they want. In Stanton, this has included projects as diverse as putting together the open-source router heard at the beginning of the story, braiding a rug, or putting together a full-sized replica of an R2-D2 unit from Star Wars. Events open to the public are also hosted periodically. Funk first heard about makerspaces 2.5 years ago from Brian Williford, who established a makerspace in Charlottesville called Tinkersmiths. While Tinkersmiths started with a similar vision to Stanton Makerspace, Tinkersmiths has now evolved to include a for-profit company that accepts a variety of different consulting projects. For Williford,
they're really becoming tech incubators, which is how we're sustaining our model. And we help incubate aligning ideas and talent with money and developing new products and services. So that's why I say it started really pure just to be a community shop, and now it's pretty ingrained in the tech community as far as being an idea incubator or a tech incubator.
By tech incubator, he means a company that provides new startups with the space, skills, training, expertise, or money needed to execute an idea.
For the last 25 years, all of the venture capital money has been focused on writing ones and zeros or writing code. But now the market has shifted back into building hardware. We have found that globally we're polluting the planet by putting things on a ship and bringing them across the ocean. We're developing them in countries that have no ecosystem controls. So So there's been a big push to build things at home again, plus it creates jobs. And all of those skills are gone. And the only place that the money guys can find these people anymore, one of the common places, are to find them hanging out in makerspaces.
Although he freely admits Tinkersmiths is not a traditional makerspace, Williford has not let go of his vision of providing a space for people to tinker. In fact, to his knowledge, Tinkersmiths is the only makerspace in the country that is able to provide their space free of charge for members, something they are able to do because they take on consulting projects. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
That drive to create is not always encouraged in many children. Beginning in grade school, arts education is often a hit-or-miss opportunity, available to some students some of the time. But despite budget cuts and other hurdles, some schools, including Harrisonburg High, are making the fine arts a priority in education. WMRA's Margie Greenfield has the story.
15 students stroll into a cavernous music room, joined by 5 teachers. This is the community learning class in Harrisonburg High School's Fine Arts Academy.
Yeah, I'm definitely planning on going into the arts as a career, maybe media, videography, photography, painting.
The only thing that I know for certain is that I want to write.
And I plan on majoring in oboe performance, which is the instrument I'm in. So
that was sophomores Piper Satva and Zoe Fox and junior Laura Ruppel. Study after study supports the value of fine arts education in our schools. A 2013 study cited by the Kennedy Center reports that arts education results in increased student learning, the development of skills in critical thinking, creativity, and communication, and a better understanding of cross-cultural issues, collaboration, community awareness, and civic engagement. Now, you might think that the need for a creative American workforce would make courses in creativity and critical thinking a national priority. In fact, school districts in Virginia have spent the past few years dealing with cuts in both state and local funding for courses that are not required for graduation. Courses such as instrumental and vocal music, visual arts, and theater classes. Harrisonburg Public Schools chose to embrace the arts and created a high school fine arts academy. For Dr. Scott Kisner, superintendent of city schools, this was not a hard sell.
That budgets are always a challenge, but budgets have to align with your belief system, and it has to align with your mission. And our mission is, in the simplest terms, is excellence and equity.
In 2012, Fine Arts Director J.R. Snow visited exemplar programs in Colorado, Texas, New Jersey, and here in the Commonwealth in Fairfax and Virginia Beach. Then he assembled the high school teachers in chorus, visual arts, drama, and creative writing. Their combined creativity is what kick-started the program into what it has become and how it continues to change.
We thought that our jobs already were to make the best artists that we could. And over the years, we've been placing children into programs all over the country at the high level performance level. And, you know, our alumni are all over the board, you know, whether they're in New York performing on stage or they're teaching the music or they are or they're artists in their own right.
Students apply to the academy in 8th or 9th grade. But do students really have a good sense of their futures at such an early age?
That's part of our soul from an early space. I think a child is drawn towards that and towards the program because they feel that. They may not have a clue what they want to do with it, but they feel that.
The faculty are more than willing to take a chance on students who may not have had the opportunity to develop skills through lessons and classes. Some, though clearly not all of the students, will go on to careers in the arts.
The workforce, the job force in any market is looking for somebody who can solve problems, is looking for somebody who can think creatively, not just bubble in the answers. And that's what we're trying to do, is allow the child to really, really think for themselves, have autonomy, create things.
The Academy faculty agree that they've never worked so hard and never enjoyed teaching more. For WMRA News, I'm Margie Greenfield.
Charlottesville is known for many things, but one of its most prominent characteristics is its artistic culture. It's a growing community interest that only seems to be developing with time. Back in December, WMRA's Sefe Emakpai took a look at some of what the city has to offer on the arts scene and spoke with some of those vying to promote the arts in Charlottesville.
On a Monday morning in downtown Charlottesville, the sounds of a running faucet and enthusiastic chatter fill the room at City Clay Studios. The intermediate class is full of students, all there for a variety of reasons, some to perfect their skills, some to relieve stress, and some simply to have some fun. Michael Stowers has lived in Charlottesville for 21 years. He spoke about why ceramics is his art form of choice.
It's a kind of meditation, and clay is such a plastic medium that you can go anywhere with it. So, and it requires both a combination of control and surrender, and particularly when you turn everything over to the fire, because you never know what's going to happen.
Randy Bill is the owner of City Clay. She says she didn't know what was going to happen when she opened the studio 3 years ago, but has been thrilled with the overall response.
Well, I think it's growing. I think we've always had a strong art community, but I think the public awareness and the public participation is growing. And what I found, which I thought was really interesting, is that the majority of people that come to us are much more interested in learning how to make art, how to make pots, how to develop their creativity than they are really in owning art and purchasing art. And I've been in this community since 1980, actually, and I've always thought it was funny that the galleries and artists in this area have difficulty selling their work. And it's not for a lack of interest. I think people here really do value the arts. They love them. They love seeing art. They love making art. But I think it's mostly about learning. They just love the opportunity to be creative.
Brian Weimer of Charlottesville's Ix Art Park might agree. The park, the first of its kind in Central Virginia, is a free and open interactive space where visitors can come and be one with the art. Different from a formal gallery, the art park joins natural surroundings with the work of a variety of local artists to produce some of the city's most interesting and intriguing work. Weimer says the location serves as another example of how Charlottesville lends itself as a hub to creativity.
The Ix property owners kind of gave me a little bit of carte blanche to do what I wanted. So all of a sudden we were doing murals and doing installations and sculptures. And actually under a year, we've had 35 works of art by different artists, different scopes and sizes. And it keeps on developing more and more. And it's more just who comes to me with a cool idea and how quickly we can make it happen.
The Ix Art Park and City Clay are just several parts of the increasing arts presence in Charlottesville. The McGuffey Art Center was established in 1975 and contains three art galleries offering one of the largest display spaces around. Art in Place is a nonprofit foundation sponsored by the Charlottesville City Council and has established numerous exhibits around the city, making art accessible to the general public. Piedmont Council of the Arts is the designated arts agency for the area and offers a wide range of support services for artists and art organizations. The Bridge Progressive Arts Initiative fashions itself as Charlottesville's creative hub, bringing together resources and space to turn ideas into action. They recently received a multi-$1,000 grant to go toward that mission.
Nance, is this too thin?
Back at City Clay, instructor Nancy Ross says financial support is something she would like to see grow more in the creative industry.
I'd like to see economic development and tourism, the Visitors Bureau, put a little more effort in making Charlottesville a destination for the visual arts versus the performing arts and the film festival and the book, which they really do a good job of. But I think the visual arts could use some of that same support.
Randy Bill agrees. She says financially thriving in the arts is difficult in Charlottesville, but the support is growing. As a former teacher, she also says the need for arts support in the younger generation is crucial, and economic discrepancies shouldn't stop children from growing into their full creative potential.
A lot of children who come from families that are not privileged, if you will, or wealthy enough to support education in the arts will even discourage their kids from it. Well, how are you going to make a living doing that? And so they don't go into the arts. But in fact, if you think about everything that we spend our hard-earned money on, it usually comes back down to design and art and creativity.
Despite economic hurdles, the Charlottesville art scene continues to blossom with the passion of people like Bill, Weimer, and Ross, who continue to promote its growth. For WMRA News, I'm Sefe Amokpai.
Now, to Martha Woodruff's conversation with Sophia Wiedemann, who has been drawing cartoons her whole life. But it took a while for her to find her own superheroes.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling
plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wished I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. Here's the first two decades of Sophia Wiedemann's life compressed into one sentence. She was raised by Foreign Service parents in mostly Latin America, came back here for college at William & Mary, double majoring in art and English, and arrived at adulthood wanting nothing as much as she wanted to draw comics.
And after college, I sort of didn't know exactly what to do with that. All I knew is that I...
Who does?
Nobody knows what to do, right? I wanted to make comics from babyhood, from basically 12 years on. I loved X-Men. I loved superhero comics. But there just came a point where I felt very alienated from the nature of those things.
Because?
Because they weren't for me. They weren't being made for me. They were being made for adolescent boys and older men as well, probably. My senior project in high school was actually, we had to write large papers, and I was like, oh, I really want to write about comics. And I ended up writing my thesis on misogyny in comic books, which was an interesting thing because I was in love with them. I was in love with this medium, and I didn't like what I saw when I took a hard glance at it. It was more than the fantasy of being a superhero. There was a lot of other stuff in there. And I didn't know how to marry my desire to basically copy these people and not emulate the sort of tropes and standards of mainstream comics. So I was kind of confused. And I was an art major, and I was painting, and I was printmaking, and I loved drawing. But after I graduated from college, it was still there, this desire to make comics, except I went to a really traditional art school. Nobody supported this. I mean, I got scowled at deeply whenever I floated this idea. Of course, at this point, now I've discovered that there's this whole other world of comics. It's not just X-Men. Reading Chris Ware changed my life. And of course, now I've read Art Spiegelman, Mouse. I've read the sort of heavy hitters of what, was considered in the 90s to be the graphic novel, which is really just comics. Yeah, so I was still consumed with this desire to do this thing. And so I just decided, well, I don't know how to do it. I'm going to art school again, and I'm going to do it. And I applied and got into the MFA in illustration program at the School of Visual Arts, which was a very narrative-friendly, figurative-friendly, and ultimately comics-friendly place to be.
I love what you got your MFA in illustration as visual essay.
Yes.
Tell me about how that ties in with your fixation on comics.
It's storytelling. That's all it is at the end of the day. Illustration is the attempt to illustrate or bring to life usually somebody's words. But really, a good illustration should be working standing on its own. And you should be able to see a story in it, find a story in it. And that was the essence of the program that we were in. Many of my teachers had come of age in a time when figurative art was a bad word, Really, narrative is it's essential to our humanness. We're story seekers. And so I was just doing words and pictures. But I found that the more words I took out of my comics, the stronger my comics became.
You talked about becoming disillusioned with the superheroes. So what kind of comics did you start doing?
I had a rough time actually figuring this out. I was doing a lot of odd stuff. There was maybe one other person who was seriously trying to do comics in my program. And my first year was kind of a mess. And then my second year, they hooked us up with these advisors. Basically, you chose your own advisor and you basically could look into the field that you were interested in. And you found somebody who was doing what you wanted to do. And I met and was, I guess, mentored by a man named David Heatley, who's a cartoonist who lives in New York. And he just taught me how to split open my brain and let it pour out onto the page. And what came out was comics. I guess that's a terrible phrase, actually. What came out was comics for people like me. Yeah.
Okay. In mere words, what does that mean?
I would love to say I write comics for girls, and I think that I do on a certain level, but I find that the people who respond to my comics, it is not defined by gender at all. So to say I write them for girls is a bit limited. I guess people who have maybe a similar worldview, they're surreal. I'd like to think they're subtle, maybe not so subtle.
Without misogyny?
They're not misogynistic. I really hope they're not. I am pretty married to the female protagonist, and maybe that's just sort of the artist's burden of pouring yourself into your work. But I'd like to think that I have retained some of the fantasy and the wonder that I found in superhero comics when I was a child without the stuff that ultimately left me feeling unspoken for. Yeah.
He taught you how to split your brain open and pour it on the page. You didn't really think I was going to let you get away with that, did you?
No, what, I guess not.
Yeah, what does that mean?
He told me how to pull it out of myself. You know, I had all these ideas, and ideas are just useless unless you can actually flesh them out and put in the, you know, the Sitzfleisch and stay with them and see them through and see where they go. I had all these evocative concepts, and that's a nonsense phrase, evocative concept. It's nonsense unless you have something to back it up. And he taught me how to write, basically. I mean, I knew how to write an essay, but he taught me how important it was to put in the time, because there's stuff underneath the surface. There's more and there's more and there's more, and there's more than you know. And the more you find, the truer it is when you finally put it on the page. It's the difference between a flat character and a nuanced one. It's the work that I put in before I actually commit to it. I handle these books. I fold them myself. I don't take them to printers. I don't trust them. I self-publish in that I print it out, I staple it, and I put a copyright date on it. That's self-published.
Tell me the difference between a graphic novel and a comic, please.
There is absolutely no difference. Graphic novel is a term that was made up to express a different type of comic. Novel implies that it has a beginning and an end, and it exists in one large volume. And graphic novel just sounds a lot more grown up than comic book, because we definitely, I think a lot of people still do, have an association of comic books with childishness, and, you know, the funnies, and, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking the funnies, I love the funnies, but it is so much more than that. It can be anything. It's not a genre, it's a medium. And so that's the difference. So graphic novel is a term that people slap on basically comics that end up in books.
What's the future with you in comics? Is it a serious part of your professional future?
Yes. Definitely. It's still the only thing that I want to do in terms of my own artistic pursuits. What I actually need to be focusing on is drawing comics.
Savior of the universe. You'll find a picture of Sophia Wiedemann, as well as links leading to some samples of her comics, on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Joy Loving, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, and an anonymous donor. You'll find stories from the WMRA newsroom and more information at our website, WMRA.org. And be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRABob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll see you in the morning. The BBC News is next.